The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org. Is the four-time World Heavyweight Poetry Bout title winner. He is the author of three books of short stories, two children, 11 volumes of poetry, two feature-length screenplays, four published novels, and he considers himself the 78th best novelist writing in the United States today. Call him Sherman. Please welcome Sherman Alexie.
I just took the shortest river walk tour ever. We kind of lost track of time. We had sushi for dinner, quickly. Hi, thanks for coming. It's a good crowd. Hi. I love my job. It's been a great tour. I'm a little tired, so it takes me a little while to rev up. This is city number 20-something, so... Philadelphia. Tour started back in the beginning of March, and I'm scared of flying, terrified of flying, and so I know I'm going to die on this tour because of the irony of the headlines. Native American writer dies in plane crash promoting flight. My first flight, I flew into Norfolk, Virginia. That is how you pronounce it. I said Norfolk, and they corrected me. No, you know, from the audience, they yelled at me, no, it's Norfolk. And they didn't say it like that. I just did it with a Rez accent. Nobody in Norfolk, Virginia has a Rez accent. I'm not sure why I did that. That local high school has a cheer. We don't drink, we don't smoke, nor fuck. And that's Booker T. Washington High School. I love my country. On the way there, though, we got into a really bad turbulence, and I was terrified because I thought I was going to die. I was sitting in first class because three women I went to high school with work front desks in Seattle at airlines. So when I come walking up, they're like, "Shermie, let me see if there's a seat." And so I was upgraded to first class, and I was sitting across the aisle from this woman who I'd noticed when she got on the plane because she was really, really hot. But don't worry, I'm a liberal feminist male, so I objectify women out of the corner of my eye. She was wearing this gray pinstripe suit, you know, very conservative, very expensive, obviously, and really well cut. But, you know, it was business. It was Willie Lominette. But I noticed that she was wearing red cowboy boots with it. And I thought, oh, you devious wench. You know, because she walks into a meeting, everybody sees her and goes, oh, you know, she's wearing the uniform. Then they look down and see the shoes, and then they're discombobulated for the rest of the meeting. So we're going through the turbulence and bucking and braying. I'm holding onto my seat going, fuck God, fuck God, fuck God. And by the way, on this tour, I got into my hotel room in Portland, Oregon, and I turned on CNN and they announced Jerry Falwell had died. And I went, yeah, and then. You know, so much for my liberal compassion. And so boom, boom, bucking and braying. And I look across the aisle, and the woman in the red cowboy boots is also hanging on to her seat really tight. And I look down at the boots, and I start thinking, these boots are made for walking. That's just what they'll do. One of these days, these boots are gonna walk all over you. Then I realized I've been singing aloud. I look up, and she's looking at me. Thing is, she's crying. She's more terrified than I am, and like any man who sees a woman crying, I immediately want to kill dinosaurs for her, Drag the meat home. And that's not a euphemism. Well, what can you do in that kind of situation, right? How do you help a stranger in that situation? And, we always have those impulses to help strangers, or at least I do. Maybe you don't. And maybe you're all cruel bastards. I don't know. Maybe you've been jaded by living in the city. First time I was here, I got pissed off, Philadelphia, because the host said to me, this is the world's oldest, this is the country's oldest street. And I thought, fuck you. What, do you think we are crawling around? You know, Indians are walking in random directions. That's not what nomadic means. So how do you help the woman? And so I reached across the aisle and offered her my hand. And she took it. So we held hands for the rest of the flight, which was about 15 minutes. But as soon as the wheels hit the tarmac, serious mourning after shame. I would have rather had sex with her in the bathroom. That would have been less intimate. It's one thing to share body fluids. It's a whole other to share fear. There is no condom for fear. So when the plane got into the, it pulled up into the I was going to say alleyway. I obviously have extensive avionautics experience. Is avionautics even a word? I think I just made up a damn word. So when we pulled into the gate, there you go, the gate. I don't know if you've ever tried to get your baggage out of the overhead or from the under the seat without ever actually turning your head or making eye contact on anybody else on the plane, but I managed, and she was doing the same thing. I could tell, we had put up this wall between us, and I ran off the plane, which then ran through the airport, which is probably not a good idea for an ambiguously ethnic guy to do in an airport. in the days after 9/11, I got searched about 80% of the time. Oh, man, I went out and bought a bunch of Eagle Creek packet cubes, which are like envelopes for clothes. And then even before you had to, I put all my toiletries and stuff in freezer bags. So I've been complimented on my packing by security guards. Sir, you pack so well. It's all for you. I find it important to homoeroticize every experience. So I'm running through the airport, and I'm getting picked up by a poetry professor. No, that's not true. A poetry professor is meeting me, and no poetry professor ever has actually picked anybody up, they've only taken advantage of their students. I knew he'd be wearing the uniform. We all wear uniforms to signify what we are. So he'd be wearing the poetry professor uniform, the gray ponytail, the balding gray ponytail. Just a word of advice for those of you who have the balding gray ponytail. It's been a long time since you fought the man. chances are pretty good you are the man. I mean, it should be written somewhere in the university bylaws, right? Guys with tenure don't get to have ponytails. So the gray ponytail, the tweed jacket, that wasn't in style when he bought it, let alone now. And the Levi's, and it used to be Birkenstocks, and then for a while it was Keens. And now it's that utter monstrosity known as the Croc. Stop. It's a gardening shoe. And if I see one more person whose croc matches their shirt, so I get to the security and he's not there. You know, my relative power and privilege has you know, de-ethnicized me. People just don't see me anymore. So too tall, too short, too fat, too thin, my hair's not the right length, I'm, you know, too light, too dark, whatever. So he wasn't there, though. I didn't see him. I figured he thought I checked my bags, but I don't sign that treaty. And so I walk on down to baggage claim, and I see him. Of course I see him. He doesn't see me, and I walk right up to him, and I say, "Hi, I'm Sherman." He goes, oh, I didn't know it was you. Yeah, I know. And apparently I'm Dutch now. And so we're talking, great guy, just a sweetheart. And one of my favorite hosts ever. And we're talking, and I glance over at baggage claim, and the woman in the red cowboy boots is standing over there. And just I have just enough melanin in my skin to where you don't see my blush. But I do blush, and so face gets all hot, and when I'm embarrassed, I tend to talk like this, and so I run into things, door frames, I trip on my own feet, run into pipes, you know, very clumsy that way, So she sees me, and it's like, oh my God. And then she says something to her husband, the guy standing there with her and two little girls, husband and daughters, and you know, he looks over at me, and my first thought is, yep, I metaphorically fucked your wife on the airplane. But then she says something else to him, and then he looks over at me again, and he smiles and waves. So I smile and wave back. When I open my eyes, I'm staring at a rat. No, that rat stares at me. He's regarding me. It's a huge wharf rat, 2.5 feet long with intelligent eyes, and the rat seems to be thinking, you're too big to eat, but I'm gonna take a bite out of your ass anyway. I panic and roll away, thinking that the rat's violent intentions might actually be amorous. What if I've dropped into the body of a rat? What if I'm about to get fucked by another rat? Shit, but no, I feel human. I am human. A human who rolls away from a rat. I roll through rotten food and dog shit and rank water and moldy newspaper and I slam into a dumpster. Damn, that hurt. But I have no time to complain. What if that rat has followed me? What if it's stalking me? What if it's ready to attack? I look back for it. My enemy. It hasn't moved. It stares at me. Fuck you, rat. My words are quickly followed by projectile vomiting. I spew half-digested food and booze toward the rat. That scares it away, and I laugh. Damn, rat, wasn't expecting that. Of course, if I hadn't scared him, that rat would gladly have eaten my vomit, and that disgusting thought makes me retch again. My stomach convulses, and I see blood in my vomit. Am I dying? Well, I'm certainly a street drunk, a loser whose belly is torn apart by booze. Yeah, why the hell am I here? What am I doing? I'm drunk. Hey, buddy! Somebody shouting at me. Hey, buddy! I see two pairs of shoes walking toward me, and I know those shoes are connected to legs and hips and faces, but I can't lift my head high enough to see. I see those faces. "You all right, dude?" It's a young man's voice. I roll over and look up at a young man and a young woman, a couple, pretty white people, cameras around their necks, genuine concern in their eyes. Gorgeous tourists. "You okay?" the young man asks again. "I'm drunk," I say. "Yes, you are." "What do I look like?" "What do you mean? Am I young or old?" The young couple look at each other and laugh. I don't mean to amuse them. I just want to know whose body I've dropped into during this goddamn time-traveling odyssey I'm on. "Am I young or old?" "You look about 50, the young woman says, "like my father." "Am I white?" "No, you're Indian." "How do you know I'm Indian?" "Because of your braids and your t-shirt." I look down, and on my t-shirt is a photograph with Geronimo and a bunch of his warriors, along with the caption, "Fighting terrorism since 1492. "Do you need some help?" the young woman asks. "What's your name?" "I'm Pam, and this is Paul." "Pam and Paul. That's fucking funny." They laugh again. He laughs so hard that he stumbles and almost steps in my vomit. He dances and spins away from it, and that makes them laugh harder. Are they drunk too? "Where am I? What city?" "Tacoma," Paul says. "Just 30 miles from Seattle. I'm getting closer to home, if not closer to my own body." "What year is it?" That makes them laugh. "Dude, you are way drunk. Just tell me what year it is, please." 2007. "It's now." "Well, no matter where you are, dude, it's always now, isn't it?" "What are you, some kind of fucking philosopher?" "Can you help me get up?" "Sure." Paul and Pam help me to my feet. I'm dizzy and I vomit again. Pam and Paul leap away as I fall to my knees, and I vomit once more, and it's filled with blood, too much blood. I must be dying. "Dude, you need a doctor. Call 911. Paul pulls his cell phone out of his pocket and dials for help. "They're on the way," he says, "but I don't want help." "No, wait. This body doesn't want help. I'm vomiting blood, but I want to flee. That doesn't make any sense, but I can't control my emotions, my fears. Yes, I'm afraid. I have to go. I don't want to say it, but I can't stop myself. I can't stop this body. This body is stronger than me, and this body wants to escape, and so I run." No, I shamble. Jesus, that's the absolute worst way in which any human can travel. Shambling. Shit. "Come back," Pam and Paul call after me. I can hear the concern in their voices, but I don't hear any passion. They're not going to follow me. They're not going to detain me. I'm not going to be anything to them other than an anecdote they can tell at dinner parties. And then there was this time we helped this homeless Indian guy. Of course, they'd revise history in order to make themselves look more heroic. And then the ambulance came, and they saved him, and the paramedic said that we'd called like 5 minutes later, he would have died. I don't look back at Pam and Paul as I continue to shamble away. I hate their alliteration almost as much as I hate their reflexive compassion. I want to hurt them. So I turn around and point a finger in their faces to accuse them, to curse them. "It's all your fault." "What?" "It's all your fault." "What's our fault?" "White people did this to Indians. You made us like this." I don't even know if I believe that, but I think this homeless body believes it. I think this 50-year-old guy wants to blame somebody for his pain and his hunger. But what if it's his fault? What if he made all the decisions that led him to this sad-ass fate? "Fuck me," I think, "and fuck this body I'm occupying. And fuck you," I say to Pam and Paul, "and fuck your whiteness, whitey white whites." Jesus, I wonder if this homeless guy understands the difference between white and whiteness, and then I wonder if I should be so condescending considering I am this homeless guy. "Please," Pam says, "we're just trying to help." "Fuck you," I say again. I don't want to say it. Not really, but this homeless guy's anger is even stronger than my anger, and anger is never added to anger, it multiplies. "The ambulance will be here soon. Please, just wait." "Did you tell him I was Indian?" "Yes." Did you tell him I was homeless? Yes. Then they ain't coming. Not for a long time, at least. I'm way down on their priority list. But you're important to us. I laugh. But I can tell she means it. And I hate her for meaning it. Her sincerity makes her weak and easily manipulated. You want to fuck me? I ask. What? Pam and Paul say together. Do you want to fuck me? I can see the sudden anger in Paul. His eyes go lightning. His hands make beautiful fists. Good. Great. I want him to hit me. I want to fight. Come on, Pam, he says. Let's get out of here. She doesn't want to go with you. She wants to stay here and fuck me. Paul takes a quick step toward me, but Pam grabs his arm. No, leave him alone. He doesn't know what he's saying. Don't let him get to you. God, she's tough. She won't let me take away her compassion. Maybe she can't be manipulated. Maybe I can't defeat her with my rage and self-hatred. Jesus, I don't understand her. I don't understand humans. He can't talk to you like that, Paul says. It's all he knows how to do. He relaxes a bit. I can tell that he listens to her. He pays attention. He takes her advice. He seeks her counsel. He respects her. I hate him for it. And I hate her for inspiring him. Hey, Paul! Does she like it in the ass? She can't stop him this time. He rushes toward me and punches me in the face. I wake up walking through an alley. I think he broke my jaw. So I shamble along, blood filling my mouth and nose, and I wonder if a man can drown in his own blood. Well, yes, of course a man can drown in his own blood, but can he drown while he's walking? If I stay upright, will I stay alive? This alley smells like rotten food. Huge dumpsters and garbage cans line both sides. They're filled with expired food and half-eaten meals. This must be an alley between rows of restaurants. Other homeless folks forage, and flocks of sparrows, pigeons, and seagulls forage, and murders of crow bully the other birds and bully the humans, too. I wish I'd wake up inside a crow. Nobody looks at me as I stagger past. I'm not an uncommon sight. I'm a beaten, bloody Indian. Who turns to look at such a man? This city is filled with beaten, bloody Indians. So what do you call a group of beaten, bloody Indians? A murder of Indians? A herd of Indians? A bottle of Indians? I want the other Indians to recognize me, to shout out my name, but they are hungry and their pain is more important than my pain. I don't even remember how I got here. I remember that Paul punched me, and then I remember stepping into the alley. I don't remember the in-between. I have lost time. That's all I know how to do now, is lose time. Jesus, I'm pathetic. Didn't I just force that poor guy to hit me? Didn't I want his violence? I'm going to walk out of this alley now, and I'm going to find a bathroom, and I'm going to wash my face and clothes. No. I'll steal some clothes, new clothes, good clothes, a white shirt and black pants, and I'll steal good shoes too, some of those brown leather ones with intricate designs carved into the cap toes, wearing good clothes. I can be a good man. And so I shamble out of the alley. No, I suck in my gut and hold my head high and my back straight, and I strut out of the alley. And people scatter. One woman points at me and screams a little. I'm covered in blood and gore. It must look like a horror movie, but that doesn't matter. I'm covered with the same blood that's inside everybody. They can't judge me because of this blood. I want some respect. Nobody hears me. Worse, nobody understands me, looks at me, pays attention to me. I want some respect. A man walks around the corner, almost bumps into me, and then he continues on. He doesn't notice me. He didn't see my blood. I follow him. He's a gray man wearing a gray suit. He's got one of those Bluetooth things in his ear. I want some respect. He stops, turns around, and looks at me. He regards me. I want some respect. I'll call you back, Jim. I got a homeless guy talking to me. So, Chief, what do you want? I want some respect. fuck are you talking about? He thinks the curse word will scare me. He thinks I'll think he once shot a man just to watch him die. I knew Johnny Cash, and you ain't no Johnny fucking Cash. The man laughs. He thinks I'm crazy. I laugh. I am crazy. He offers me a handful of spare change. There you go, chief. Go live it up. I don't want your money. I want your respect. The man laughs again. His laughter, all he can expect. Don't laugh at me. All right, chief. I won't laugh at you. You have a good day. He turns to walk away, but I grab his shoulder. He grabs my arm and judos me into a wall. All right, chief, I don't want you touching me. Don't touch me. He could snap my bones if he wanted to. He could drive his thumb into my temple and kill me. I can feel his strength, his skill, his muscle memory. It's my turn to laugh. What's so funny? I'm just wondering how many white guys are going to beat my ass today. He says, chief, you keep acting like this and we're all gonna beat your ass today. That makes us both laugh, and we almost bond over our shared amusement. Okay, chief, I'm gonna let you go, and when I do, I want us both to act like gentlemen. I want some respect. Are you gonna be a gentleman? I want some respect. How many times are you gonna say that? I'm gonna say it until I get some respect. The man looks around. He realizes that he's pinned a homeless man to a wall in downtown Seattle at lunchtime. Not one of his prouder moments. All right. How do I show you respect? Jesus, I don't have an answer for that. And then I remember, respect isn't exactly what I want. This body wants respect, and I don't know what I want, and I don't know how to define respect for me or this homeless guy. So I do the Indian thing and take a guess. Tell me a story, I say. You want me to tell you a story? Yeah, and that will give you respect. Yeah. The guy pauses again. He is flabbergasted to be in this situation. And I'm flabbergasted that I just used the word flabbergasted. This old Indian guy has an old-fashioned vocabulary. All right, chief, what kind of story do you want to hear? Something personal. Something you haven't told anybody. Something secret. I can't tell you a secret. I don't even know you. And then he realizes that he can tell me anything precisely because he doesn't know me. Anybody can be your priest. All right, I'll tell you a story. A bird story. Bird stories are my favorite. Oh, shut the fuck up. He lets me go and takes a step back, and then he waits to see if I'm going to attack him. I don't. I'm listening, I say. All right. I have this daughter, Jill. She's 7 years old. For 5 years, she's been wanting a pet. Dog, cat, anything with four legs. Kids like pets. Okay, tell me something I don't know, Captain Obvious. Just let me tell the story. Then tell it. I'm trying to tell it, so shut up. Okay, I'm shutting up. So, okay, we don't want a cat or a dog or a turtle or whatever because we don't want to clean up shit, and we don't want to clean up a lot of shit. So my wife and I, we walk into the pet store, we walk up to the clerk, and we ask him what kind of animal shits the least. Fish? See there, that's what I thought too. Little fish, little poop. But then the clerk says fish might shit small, but they shit in their own water. So the aquarium becomes one big liquid shit. Exactly. Gallons of shit and piss. So the clerk says that snakes only eat once a month, so they only shit once a month. And then you asked him, what kind of asshole father gives his 7-year-old daughter a snake? I didn't say it in so many words, but that's essentially the meaning. Then what did the clerk say? The clerk said, bird. What? He said, parakeet. Small bird, small shit. Exactly. And you believed him. Yeah, stupid of me, right? I mean, we took that little bird home, and he was a shit master. poop, 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 poop everywhere. And you hated it, right? Well, I didn't like the shit, but I fell in love with that bird. The man's embarrassed to admit that. I like him for it. He's a smart little bastard. Could talk, dance to AC/DC, you know. He shook you all night long. And he sat on my shoulder all the time. You let him out of the cage while he was clipped. Clipped wing bird ain't a bird. All right, Dr. Earth first. I'm not the one who clipped him. We bought him that way, and it wasn't like we planned on making him a tiny little Thanksgiving dinner, all right? So give me a break. We loved that bird. I loved him. My daughter named him Harry Potter. That's cute. Damn right it's cute. But you want to hear the cutest part? Yeah. I'm the cook of the family, the Mr. Mom, the domestic, and Harry Potter loved to sit on my shoulder while I was cooking and insult my food. No, yep. My wife and daughter taught him how to say, I'm being poisoned, I'm being poisoned, I'm being poisoned, or too much salt, too much salt. That's hilarious. Yes, it is. And there's more. You see, my daughter's favorite dish is pasta anything, so I'm always boiling water. And Harry Potter is always sitting on my shoulder. Oh, shit. You got that right. So last week, Harry Potter sitting on my shoulder, and maybe he forgot he couldn't fly, or maybe he thought the pot of boiling water was a bird bath. All I know is that he fucking splashed into the water. Oh, man, you cooked him? Well, he wasn't in there but a second. I reached in and grabbed him, burned the shit out of my hand. And where was your daughter? She was right beside me. And she was screaming like she was the one who fell into the water. You killed their bird. I didn't kill the bird. It was suicide. Well, it was attempted suicide. The thing is, you know, I had him in my hand, right? And he was laying there with his arms all spread out. He looked like Jesus. I swear to you, he looked like a little Jesus. So he's laying there like this, and I looked down at him, and he's just moving a little bit. I can see his little eyes flickering. So I don't know what to do, right? So I lean over and I put my mouth over his beak and I take my pinky on his chest and I perform the world's smallest CPR. The thing was, I did that for like 30 seconds and then he went like this and he was alive. You know, I brought him back. And he looks up at me, and I swear to you, he regarded me. He looked at me like, why the fuck did you let me jump into the water? Oh, man, what did you do? I didn't know what to do. The bird was all burned, right? It smelled like Thanksgiving, and my daughter's there screaming. So I ran over to the phone book. I was looking at veterinarian, right, which starts with a V, but brilliant me, you know, great in a panic. I started from the beginning, A, B, C, D, and I got to the end. Did you know they have 24-hour veterinarian hospitals? Wow, I didn't know that. Did they send an ambulance? Fuck no, they didn't send an ambulance. So I call him and they say, get over here right now, right? So I put the bird on a towel and my daughter and I jump in the car and she's holding him in her lap, the bird on a towel, burned bird on a towel. I think you can get that at any French restaurant. And I'm driving like a madman through the streets of Seattle and I pull in front of the 24-hour veterinarian place and I grab the bird and my daughter and I rush in and I swear to you, it's just like some friggin' movie, right? Because the veterinarian and the nurses came rushing out from back toward us and it was like in slow motion. I could hear the theme music, right? And they took the bird from us and they ran back in to where they go back there. And so we're sitting in the waiting room and my daughter is screaming and screaming and screaming and I pick her up and that doesn't help. She just keeps screaming. I'm looking around the waiting room and she's making everybody cry and they're already crying because it's, you know, 10 at night. They're all in the emergency ER with their pets. It was the waiting room of the damned. So we sit down. My daughter's just crying and crying and crying. And about half an hour later, my wife shows up and my daughter runs into her arms, just jumps into her arms, and they're crying in the middle of the waiting room together. And all my daughter can keep saying is, Harry Potter, Harry Potter, Harry Potter. And then all gets quiet. And the doors open and the vet comes walking out slow, walking toward us, you know, every footstep echoing. Boom, boom, boom. And my wife and daughter turn to him, and my daughter says, where's Harry Potter? And the vet says, it's not looking good. And my daughter says, "Can I see him?" And the vet says, "I think that would be best." So we walk back, three of us with the vet. We walk through the doors and down this hallway. We turn a corner. And there's a sign above this room that says, "Avian ICU." But that's not the big thing. I walk into the room, and I can't see at first because my wife's in the way, but she steps to the side, holding my daughter, and Harry Potter's laying there on the table. And he's got little tubes. And these little tiny electrodes hooked up to the world's tiniest heart machine. It's this big. And it's going beep, 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 beep. And I started laughing. I mean, laughter that comes from your asshole up through your belly. Out your mouth. I was crying. I was laughing so hard. And then I looked over, saw the vet looking at me, my wife looking at me with the same eyes, and then my daughter. And she was so disappointed. I've never seen anybody so ashamed of someone else. Damn. What happened then? My wife took my daughter. Walked out. I haven't seen them since. Went to her mom's. Leave messages, and her mom calls me back and on my machine and just says, "Fuck you." You ever had your mother-in-law say, "Fuck you"? Man. Do you have any pictures of the bird? No, of your daughter. The gray man pulls out his wallet and pulls out a photograph of a pretty little blonde. "Wow, she's beautiful." "I know." "So, do you feel respected now, Chief? Have I told you the proper kind of story?" "Yeah. All right. I'm leaving." The gray man walked away, was like half a block away before he stopped and turned around and yelled back at me, "Do you have any kids?" "I don't know." I dig through my pockets and I pull out this pack of cards and receipts and papers wrapped with a rubber band, and I snap off the rubber band and I go through the stuff until I see a photograph of little 5-year-old Indian boy. Indian boy with green eyes. That 5-year-old's me. Don't know why this homeless guy has a photograph of me in his pocket. I look up and the gray man's gone. So I walk over to a delivery truck on the street there and I turn the sideways mirror and I look at my reflection. And I'm looking at the face of my father. This guy has a picture of me in his wallet because he's my father. I've dropped into the body of my father. I am my father. Who can survive such a revelation? Questions? Oh, you don't, you know, you don't have, oh, are you carrying a mic? Are you a mic carrier? I thought you were asking a question. I was saying, you don't have to come all the way down. The mic probably works anywhere in the room. You don't have to be so excited. No questions? That's all right with me. Oh, yes.
Did you survive that revelation?
Did I survive that revelation? I've been talking about that for 22 years of therapy. You know, I don't know if you heard me on Marty Moscone today. Moscone, sorry, Marty. It turned into some kind of therapy session when I realized, because I've always been thinking this book is about some other kid, some fictional kid, and all of a sudden Marty pointed out to me, you're writing about you and your father, aren't you? Fuck you, Marty. No, nor fuck you, Marty, nor fuck you. And I didn't say that. I like Marty very much. But I mean, you know, everything's autobiography. Every writer is always writing autobiography, no matter what else we try to do. It's always about our obsessions. And of course, my relationship with my father is my primary obsession. And he died 4 years ago of alcoholism, which always pisses me off when anybody accuses me of writing stereotypes. My dad, whose name is Sherman Alexie, I am Sherman Alexie Jr., died of alcoholism 4 years ago. Yes, the father of the writer, Sherman Alexie, named Sherman Alexie, died of alcoholism 4 years ago. So fuck you and your fucking ideas about fucking stereotypes I might be writing about. It's not true. It's a damp reality for me. So obviously I still have issues. Thank you for bringing them up. I always find that being as pathetic as possible somehow or another makes me more sexy. Women in the crowd going, oh. Certain kind of woman in the crowd really getting excited. Oh, you're going to treat me like shit because of it. Oh, I'm going to love you. Yes.
I was curious to know why you chose a 15-year-old to be the traveling consciousness in the story.
Why did I choose a 15-year-old to be the traveling, time-traveling? I was working on a young adult novel at the time. I do have a young adult novel coming out this fall called The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. And that's a much funnier, gentler coming-of-age tale. But this rowdier, more disassociated, dysfunctional, violent voice kept popping out. And I'd go off on these tangents. And then I'd go, that's not this character. And I'd put the tangent aside. And over the course of a year, I realized I had 70 pages of rowdy tangent. And I thought, I think that's another novel. So I put it all together and I was kind of shaping it. And while I was shaping it, I reread Kurt Vonnegut's Slaughterhouse-Five, in which his lead character, Billy Pilgrim, comes unstuck in time. And I thought, zits, comes unstuck in time. Cool. And it was funny, the things you don't think about. I did not think about this, but people assign all these values to it, right? People kept asking me, were you influenced by Quantum Leap? I mean, I like that show, but I swear to you, Quantum Leap never entered my mind. Scott Bakula is not on my list of literary influences, and I could prove it to you because if I had thought of Quantum Leap, I would have had my character jump into the body of a woman. Because in watching that show, Quantum Leap, whenever he jumped into the body of a woman, it was rendered completely unbelievable. Because what's the first thing a man would do if he found himself in the body of a woman? He would masturbate like crazy. So I'm so mad at the lost opportunity Imagine a 15-year-old boy dropped into the body of a grown woman. You know, he would have been, you know, sliding up and down banisters for days. So I missed out on a big opportunity. More serious topics as well. You know, the gender confusion, the ideas of getting treated like a woman when you're a man. The opportunities for conflict were huge, and I blew it. So Quantum Leap would have actually been a better influence on me if I'd paid attention. But it was that combination of stuff. A young adult novel, a character that jumped out of the novel, Slaughterhouse-Five. It's a weird alchemy. I don't know why. Even when I'm up here, I don't always know where this stuff is coming from. I don't think it first. Because if I did that, there's all sorts of stuff I would not say. I mean, as soon as I said it, I thought, why did you just do a banister masturbation joke? You know, which flashed me back to a woman in high school I knew who, during this state basketball tournament, she was playing in the band, and she stepped over a railing to go to the band section, and she slipped and... I won't continue with that one. She's still one of my friends. She upgrades me to first class all the time. Everything's a circle. Yes.
What do you enjoy more, writing fiction or poetry,
Fighting fiction?
Fighting fiction.
Oh, I thought you said fighting fiction. What do you enjoy more, fighting fiction?
Writing fiction or writing poetry, or do you miss the performance?
Do I miss performing? Oh, I was gonna say. Thought I just had an out-of-body experience. Is somebody else doing this? Must have been too much mercury in my sushi. No, I still perform poetry. I'll do one for you now. It's called To the Housefly in the Ramada Inn at 3 in the morning. Little terrorist, if I tell you I believe in your cause, will you leave me be? That's the kind of shit I win poetry slams with. Because everybody else gets up and, you know, and they read their... Here's how poetry slams always go. It's the same rhythms. And then I said, I hate Whitey. Whitey fucks me every day. Fuck Whitey. You know, and everybody's going, yay! I just insulted poets. Talk about picking it on an unimportant crowd. So it always makes me laugh, though. The smaller the reward, the greater the infighting. Poets are mean to each other. You know, and it's like squirrels fighting over, like, it's like every squirrel in the world fighting over one acorn. It's like, you know, nobody's watching. Well, we're hoping someday they do. I'm thinking maybe the poets should start training to be ultimate fighters. You know, like Chuck Liddell versus Richard Wilbur. Two people got that joke. But you're my people. Yes.
Writing about
ourselves.
So you're asking me if I stalk people? Talking to you? It just did. I wanted to keep a straight face and I couldn't. It would have been funnier if I could have kept a straight face. I get the comedy bronze, not the comedy gold. Dang it, I telegraphed it. I should have paused, had the caesure. But no poetry professors in the crowd? Well, we heard you were insulting us, so we didn't come. And when I started writing, I used to follow people to sort of investigate their lives. I still do it a little bit. I'm a pop culture voyeur, so I like watching. In bookstores, I like walking around, seeing what people are browsing and looking at. And I love iPods because you can see what they're listening to. So I peer over people's shoulders. What are you doing? I'm not looking at your breasts. I'm looking at your iPod. You can no longer hide your air supply fetish. Girl, you're every woman in the world to me. You're my fantasy. You're my reality. Okay, so it's my air supply fetish. It's just those dramatic collisions between people, and that seems to be the easiest way to do it. I mean, every piece of art starts that way, I think, pretty much. Strangers meeting. So it's sort of just an archetypal story structure. I hadn't really thought about the way I use it. But, you know, the first story, you know, was about, you know, a man and a woman going, "Who are you?" "Oh, I'm Adam." So, you know. We're all created because strangers got hot for each other. It's true. Although my mom and dad weren't exactly strangers, my mom and dad first met when she gave him helped him get a drink of water at a water fountain. She was 14, he was 5. It's cute and sort of perverted. They're also third cousins. Which explains a lot. I think it's just an archetypal story structure. It's a kind of question that I hadn't even really considered, and now I'm thinking, I think she's right. Damn. So I'm going to have to think about it more. I'll get back to you. I'm blogging the book tour, so I'm going to be writing about that question. That's sort of intense, and I'm feeling vulnerable. See, that's the problem with being funny. People think you're always trying to be funny, and I wasn't there. I was trying to share a real and tender moment with you, inconsiderate bastards. Yes?
How did that one, The Lone Ranger, get inspired to Heaven? That's one of my favorite books. At first, I was reluctant to read it because, like, I had to read it for an English class, so I didn't read it until some after course.
What influenced me to write The Lone Ranger and Tonto Fistfight in Heaven? It was my first fiction writing class in college, and I took the class because I'd taken a poetry writing class and I liked writing poems. So I took the fiction class because this woman I really liked in the poetry class was going to be taking the fiction class. And she came up to me and said, "Are you going to take the fiction class?" And I said, "Yes." So you talk about chance encounters and strange meetings. I honestly think I'm a fiction writer because of Christy. Who is now my assistant. She works for me. So everything's a circle. So But it was really once I started writing the book, really, you know, everything's autobiography. I remember I got so mad when the book came out, when people would say, how autobiographical is this book? It's not, it's fiction. And then a few years ago when we did the 10th anniversary edition and I reread it for the first time in many years, I thought, oh man, this is memoir, Jesus. Man, I was an asshole on that book tour. So it really was sort of the first chance I'd been given permission to say everything. So that's really what did it. It was this explosion of stories. The Lone Ranger and Tonto, 90% of it I wrote in 4 months and during my first fiction writing class. So, boom. So I say that at MFA programs and they go, oh, fucker. But then I ease their minds. But it's been downhill ever since. You know, the writing quality goes down. My audience keeps growing, but my talent is diminishing. So it really was the first sort of scream, cry, and it's, you can tell. That sucker has, you know, 750,000 copies in print, and I think you can hear the, you know, I read it now and it sounds like somebody else, and. I like whoever that is. So, yeah, I like that kid. Yeah, handsome guy back there. You are handsome. And is that your girlfriend, wife? You're both hot.
Do you do stand-up comedy?
Do I do stand-up comedy? That depends. What do you want me to do? If you ask politely. He is hot. I have done clubs, yes. But it's a whole different thing when you walk into a comedy club and say you're going to do comedy, because if you're not funny in that environment, you're just not funny. But if you do a literary reading and you try to be funny and you're not funny, then you can just say, oh, he was being artistic. So it's so funny, though, that I'm the funny one, because if you ask, it's so funny that I'm the funny one. There you go. There's tautology for you. I totally lost myself. My siblings, when people ask them, you know, he's so funny. Or my wife, when people walk up to her and go, your husband's so charming. You know, and my siblings think, yeah, he was the morose guy in the basement playing Dungeons and Dragons all by himself. And my wife says, yeah, he's the morose guy in the basement playing Dungeons and Dragons all by himself. So the comedy comes from pain. I've just found that by being funny, I can say anything to anybody. And I offend only those people who I really want to offend. I've noticed that the people who get mad when I'm funny are the people I want to be mad. But because I'm funny, I get invited everywhere to people whose views are radically different than mine. Because I'm a public Christian, I'm a Catholic, I get invited to evangelical meetings. And I'll do my Jesus material. You know, to right-wing Christians, and they're dying, and then they're saved, and you know, like the whole concept of Jesus, you know, which is hilarious. I mean, I love Jesus, but think about it, you know, whole religion based on a guy who rose from the dead. We Indians call that a zombie. You know, and then I'm a Catholic, and you know, other certain denominations practice Eucharist, communion, you know, which you know is a metaphor. Certainly, you know, the bread and the, you know, the wine is the flesh and blood of Jesus. But if you take it to its furthest level, to transubstantiation, the bread and the wine become the blood and flesh of Jesus. Not a metaphor. Become the blood and flesh of Jesus. We Indians call that cannibalism. So you're talking about a religion based on the cannibalization of a zombie. And you guys freaked out because Indians thought everything had spirit. And then we can get into a serious discussion about the differences in religions, you know. So, but the humor always works. Well, not always. Mostly. You liked it, and I like pleasing you. I love the whole gay thing. I'm all for gay marriage, because I want them to share in the hell and pain of it. I think it's unfair that an entire group of people can't experience the misery that is marriage. Talk about privileged. You know, I really loved it when Brad Pitt and Angelina Jolie announced, you know, Brad Pitt announced, we're not going to get married until all people can get married. And people went, oh, that's so cool. And I was thinking, oh, you bastard. You just turned your fear commitment into a political movement. All over the country, guys were going, yeah! Now when my girlfriend starts pressuring me, I'm just going to say, but we can't get married until all people can get married. I mean, the thing is, gay marriage, liberals too. This crowd is mostly liberal because you're the literate ones. But there are some of you liberals who are against gay marriage. Polls show it, but you're in the closet about it. You know, you're at the liberal barbecue, and all the real liberals start talking about gay marriage, and you're just sitting there quietly with your tofu. You're a soy furkey. And you get freaked out because you have a physical reaction to the idea of people with the same sex organs going at it. I mean, that just makes me laugh. How can you be threatened by that? I mean, dicks are funny anyway by themselves. You get two or more in a room, man. But the thing is, I understand why some people would feel a physical revulsion to it, because one of the arguments is always that, you know, gay is genetic. I believe that. But there's a spectrum of sexuality from way gay to way straight. And I understand why somebody who is genetically way straight would have a physical revulsion to gay sex. I understand that, but that doesn't mean you get to make political policy based on your revulsion to a physical act. Because, let me tell you, looking around the room... I would have sex with about 22 women in here. 23. And 24, 25, 26, and up to 45. And about three men. And about the rest of you? Thing is, I'm not going to base my opinion of you based on my lack of sexual attraction to you. And I'm not going to base my politics on my physical sexual reaction to your appearance. You know, talk about judging things by surface level, you know. I mean, what you were saying when you're against gay marriage is that this entirely huge group of people, that millions and millions of people worldwide are incapable of sustaining human connection over long periods of time. That's what you're saying. It's not true, you know. And I mean, and the thing too is we married people know that if you anti-gay marriage people want them to stop having sex, let them get married. and adopt as many children as possible. I have two kids. I've been married 13 years. We have alarm clock sex. You know, you read the stories, you put the kids to bed, you go into your room, you lay in bed, you set the alarm clock. One? How about 1:15? Beep, 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 beep. Hit the snooze. Beep, 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 beep. Are you ready? Can we just cup each other's crotches? And you conservatives are always going on and on about personal responsibility, personal responsibility, personal responsibility, and yet you're always coming up with these things that I somehow can't resist, you know, that are going to take me over. Gay marriage threatens straight marriage. Gay men threaten marriage. Sherman, gay men threaten your marriage. Gay men don't threaten my marriage. Gay men catered my marriage. You know what threatens my marriage? Good-looking straight women with no boundaries. There ought to be a law. Have I ever considered running for political office? I'm a brown guy who talks shit. I would be assassinated within 1 week of announcing. Plus, I've got an armada of skeletons in my closet. My skeletons have little skeletons inside the skull. If I announced my candidacy for an office, I'd have to have up on stage with me everybody I've had sex with. You know, like 15 women, 2 guys, and a jar of peanut butter. My brother's nickname for me, because he caught me for many years, was Jiffy. You know, but the thing is, I don't have a party anymore. I don't know what I would be. I no longer believe in the Democratic Party. I no longer believe in the Republican Party. I no longer believe in the left or the right. The right has always pissed me off. That's a given. But since 9/11, you lefties have pissed me off even more. And it started, I was part of the Seattle Planning Committee for the anti-Iraq war marches. You know, I used to get claps. You know, but we don't clap anymore because we didn't stop shit. And now 80% of the country's against it, so it doesn't make you distinguishable. But on the planning committee, I just kept saying, can we have a dress code? A dress code, please. Imagine the power of 150,000 Seattle leftists marching in suits. Imagine the visual power of that, of taking back the imagery. Let's carry flags, let's do the Pledge of Allegiance, let's sing the Star Spangled Banner. Let's take the patriotic imagery back. But no, we don't want to upset anybody's individual expression. You know, well, if we can't have a dress code, can we at least keep the sea turtles out? The thing is, in Seattle, no matter what the march, these eight people show up dressed as sea turtles. You're gonna have a cartoon character. Can it be SpongeBob at least? But no, you know, we had to have the usual 150,000 patchouli stink army walk in. And then that night, I was watching cable television. It was covering the anti-war marches, and it's the local news channel that covers Portland, Seattle, and Spokane, that triangle of power. And they showed a Portland, Oregon protest march, and this woman was carrying a sign that said, "Vegans for World Peace." And at first I read it as "Vegans for World Peace," and that made sense. Seemed tangential, but it made sense. And then I saw what it was, and I got so mad, I thought, "Oh, you fundamentalist bitch. I mean, what does it say about you, you know, that sign? I mean, diagram the sentence. Vegans for world peace. Peace is in the prepositional phrase. But what does it say that you'd never see a sign that said meat eaters for world peace? Or backyard rib barbecuers for international nuclear disarmament? I could carry that sign. I'm not gonna, because I don't connect my diet to my politics. I mean, just imagine the sheer fantasy of living in a country where you're rich enough and privileged enough to get to choose what you eat at each and every meal. Can you imagine? I can't imagine a country like that. I can't imagine a civilization like that where you get to base your politics on the fact that you're a rich fucking country. I can't imagine that, and yet you're judging it, you know. It should say vegans for the interstate trucking system, vegans for freeways, vegans for petroleum, vegans for refrigeration. That's vegans for capitalism. Then I'd believe your ass. Until then, you're just another fundamentalist, right? Scratch a vegan, you get a Stalinist. And you're making moral judgments yourself. You're saying that carrots are less important than cows. I think they're equal. I mean, we started out as food, human beings. We were the plankton of the earth, but we worked our way up the food chain year by year by year, and now we're at the top, and I'm not about to turn my back on tens of thousands of years of my ancestors' struggles. And the reason why, we have these. We pray all wrong. We cover them. We should pray like this. I'm telling you, God is an opposable thumb. We use these, brain got bigger, thumbs, brain, thumbs, brain, you know? And I mean, if you vegans were serious, if you thought we were equal to the animals, you'd cut these fuckers off. Try to pick up your tofu then. I'd rather go to a prayer breakfast at Jerry Falwell than eat lunch with a vegan. You know, thing is, I get more death threats from vegans than I do from any other group. That's okay. What's a vegan gonna do? It's organic! Way in the back. What books am I reading now? You ruined the fun by asking a real question. I'm reading Vegans Are the Worst People on Earth by John Porkloin. Don't laugh at that. That's horrible. Don't encourage him. Let's see, what do I have with me? I'm looking at, you know, I've been on book tour, so people keep handing me books. I have 30 books in my suitcase. But what I've read on tour is Mo Hayden is a mystery writer, so I just read her book called The Monster of Nanking, which is amazing. I have a book of poems with me by a guy named Frank Stanford, who used to date Lucinda Williams way back when. Drunken Angel is sort of about Frank Stanford and about a Texas songwriter, blanking on his name, who also died drunkenly, stupidly. What? Yes, Towns Van Zandt. Thank you. Yeah, you know, drunken fool, but damn, he could sing. What else do I have with me? I have David Mitchell's book, Black Swan Green, which is amazing. I highly recommend Black Swan Green. Black Swan Green by David Mitchell, one of my favorite books of the last few years. I have another book of poems by a woman named Brenda Shaughnessy. That's pretty amazing. I have many, many more. I've been reading a lot of magazines because I've been on airplanes. I've been watching a lot of porn. My press pays for everything in the hotel room, so I have no issue. $12.95, I don't care. I'm getting the all-day package. I miss my wife. Yes, in the back. Red shirt. And you scared the hell out of your students. Hey, students, we're gonna read a dark and depressing book about interracial murder. So in other words, you want me to do your job? I have no idea why people like that book. I don't like the book. I'm happy that other people like it, but I don't know what to teach about it. I don't know. You know what I think you should do? I think you should start teaching flight because it's the new one. That's how you're going to help me deal with my anger. Oh, man. The only concept I think is it popping into my head is that every character in the book has a doppelganger. So the concept of doppelgangers as expressed in the book. People think it's an anti-white book, but it's actually an anti-fundamentalist book. The Indians in the book are not heroic whatsoever. They're guilty of the same sins as the white folks. So there's a concept to think about when you're teaching it. Very Catholic view. Start with the view that the author is very Catholic in all the good and bad ways. So, and that'll freak him out. What? He's Catholic and he's Indian? That's guilt squared. Trust me, in confession next week, I'll be going, Excuse me, Father. Excuse me. Excuse me, Father. Oh, man. Forgive me, Father. Before I said, excuse me. Can I be excused from this confessional? Nothing they can say after that's going to be funny. So there's some concept. Catholicism, everybody's a sinner, doppelgangers. The concept in my mind, I was writing a why done it, not a who done it. And the fact that I think everybody in the novel, through their energy, creates the Indian killer. So there's some concepts to talk about. And you're saying, right, like I didn't already fucking know that. Tell me something new, Mr. Big Time Author. So in the middle there?
I had another question about Indian killers.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.